Disc 2.
1997. Martin Odom discovers that not much is sacred. From Lower Manhattan, as the crow flies, Crown Heights is a mere 4 miles across the river, but a world away. Since race riots raged in its streets in the early 1990s, this particular section of Brooklyn had enjoyed a degree of extraterritoriality. Riding in squad cars with the mantra, courtesy, professionalism, respect, visible on the doors not spattered with mud, police officers patrolled the neighborhood during daylight hours, but only for the most flagrant crimes would they abandon the relative safety of their vehicles. Depending on which street you were on, in some cases which sidewalk, different mafias ruled. On the streets south of Eastern Parkway off Nostrand Avenue, the Lubavitchers, solemn men in black suits and black hats, busied themselves reading the Torah in neighborhood shuls and obeying its 613 commandments while they waited for the Messiah, who was expected to turn up any day now, by the weekend at the very latest. Because the end of the world was nigh, Lubavitchers were enthusiastic about mortgages, the longer the better. But they hesitated buying anything they couldn't immediately consume. They didn't get involved in fights they couldn't finish before darkness fell. One block further down President, on Rogers Avenue, the Lubavitchers gave way to African Americans crowded into tenements. Ghetto blasters, with the volume turned up, drowned out the occasional shrieks of addicts who needed a hit but didn't have the cash to pay for it. The West Indian ghetto, with its tidy streets and social clubs and block parties that had young people strolling in the gutter until dawn, began a few blocks further south on Empire Boulevard. Where the denizens of the different ghettos rubbed shoulders, tensions ran high. Everyone understood it only needed a spark to set off a conflagration. Martin, an outsider in all of the Crown Heights ghettos, knew enough to keep his head down and avoid looking anyone in the eye when he walked the streets. The sun was up and toasting the crispness out of the air as he made his way down Schenectady, past a large rent strike sign whitewashed onto a storefront window, past several broken shopping carts with small placards saying they were the property of Throckmorton's mini market on Kingston Avenue, kindly return. His leg with the pinched nerve was starting to ache as he turned onto President, a wide residential street with trees and two-story homes on either side. He stepped off the sidewalk to make way for three Lubavitch women, one more anemic than the other, all of them wearing long skirts and kerchiefs over their shaven heads. They didn't so much as glance in his direction, but went on prattling to each other in a language Martin couldn't identify. As he neared Kingston, he came abreast of an ambulance with a Jewish Star of David painted on the door, parked in front of a brownstone that had been converted into a synagogue. Two pimply young men, with embroidered skull caps on their heads and long sideburns curling down to their jaws, sat in the front seats listening to Bob Dylan on the tape deck. Once across Kingston Avenue, Martin began to search for the house numbers. Two-thirds of the way down the block, he found the big house that Estelle Kastner had described. A narrow flagstone walkway led to the side door with the light burning over it. He continued past the house without stopping and turned right on Brooklyn Avenue and then right again on Union Street, all the while watching the streets for the telltale signs that he was being followed, either by someone on foot or in a car. He felt a certain nostalgia for the good old days in the boondocks when he would have had a sweeper or two trailing after him to make sure he was clean and tidy up behind him if he wasn't. Nowadays, he was obliged to make do with rudimentary tradecraft precautions. Streets and alleyways and intersections, the lobbies of buildings with their banks of elevators, the toilets in the backs of restaurants and the windows in the backs of the toilets that looked out on alleyways. He took it all in as if his life might one day depend on remembering what he saw. Halfway down Union, he climbed the front steps of a brownstone and stabbed at the bell. An old man in an undershirt flung open an upstairs window and shouted down, "What you want?" "Looking for a family, name of Grossman," Martin called back. "You're barking up the wrong block," the man yelled. "The Jewish, they live on President Street. Union is still, thanks to God, reasonably Roman." With that, he pulled his head back into the house and slammed the window shut. Martin stood on the stoop for a moment, feigning confusion as he surveyed the street in either direction. Then he doubled back the way he'd come and made his way along President Street to the flagstones that led to the side entrance with the light over it. He was about to knock on the "No Peddlers" sign when the door was pulled open. Stella, wearing tight jeans with a man's shirt tucked into them, stood inside, squinting up at him. The same three top buttons of her shirt were unbuttoned, revealing the same triangle of pale chest. Strangely, Martin found her more attractive than he remembered. He noticed her hands for the first time. The nails were neither painted nor bitten. The fingers themselves were incredibly long and extremely graceful. Even her chipped front tooth, which had struck him as downright ugly when they met the day before, seemed like an asset.
"Well, if it isn't the barefoot gumshoe, Martin Odom, private eye," Stella said with her mocking grin.
She let him in and slipped his valise under a chair. "In that raincoat," she said, taking it from him and hanging it on a vestibule hook, "you look like a foreign correspondent from a foreign country. I saw you limp past 10 minutes ago," she announced as she led him up a flight of stairs and into a windowless walk-in closet. "I concluded that your leg must be hurting. I concluded also that you're paranoid someone might be following you. I'll bet you didn't call me from home. I'll bet you called from a public phone." Martin grinned. "There's a booth on Lincoln and Schenectady that smells like a can of turpentine." A booming voice behind Martin exclaimed,
"My dear Stella, when will you learn that some paranoids have real enemies? I was watching from an upstairs window when he limped down President Street. Our visitor has the haunted look of someone who would circle the block twice before visiting his mother."
Martin spun around to confront the corpulent figure wrapped in a terry cloth robe and crammed into a battery-powered wheelchair. Scratching noisily at an unshaven cheek with the nicotine-stained fingers of one hand, working a small joystick with the other, the man piloted himself into the closet, elbowed the door closed behind him, and backed up until his back was against the wall. The naked electric bulb, dangling from the ceiling, illuminated his sallow face. Studying it, Martin experienced a twinge of recognition. In one of his incarnations, he'd come across a photograph of this man in a counterintelligence scrapbook. But when? And under what circumstances?
"Mr. Martin Odom and me," the man growled in the grating voice of a chain smoker, "are birds of a feather. Tradecraft is our Kabbalah."
He scraped a kitchen match against the wall and sucked a foul-smelling cigarette into life.
"Which is how I came to meet you in this safe room," he plunged on,
taking in with a sweep of his arm the shelves filled with household supplies, the mops and brooms and the vacuum cleaner, the piles of old newspapers waiting to be recycled.
"Both of us know there are organizations that can eavesdrop on conversations over the landlines. It does not matter if the phones are on their hooks."
Stella made a formal introduction.
"Mr. Odom, this is my father, Oscar Alexandrovich Kastner."
Kastner removed a pearl-handled Tula Tukaria from the pocket of his terry-cloth robe and set the handgun down on a shelf. Martin, who understood the value of gestures, accepted Kastner's decision to disarm with a nod. All the tradecraft talk had tripped a memory. Suddenly, Martin recalled which counterintelligence scrapbook he'd been studying when he came across the face of Stella's father. It was the one filled with mugshots of Soviet defectors.
"Your daughter told me you were Russian," Martin said lazily.
"She didn't say you were KGB. Kastner, nodding excitedly, gestured toward a plastic kitchen stool, and Martin scraped it over and settled onto it. Stella leaned back against a folded stepladder, half sitting on one of its steps.
"You are a quick wit, Mr. Martin Odom,"
Kastner conceded, his bushy eyebrows dancing over his heavy-lidded eyes.
"My body has slowed down, but my brain is still functioning correctly, which is how come I am still cashing my annuity checks. It goes without saying, but I will anyhow say it. I checked you out before I sent Stella over to test the temperature of the water."
"There aren't that many people in the neighborhood you could have checked me out with," Martin observed, curious to identify Kastner's sources.
"Your name was suggested to me by someone in Washington, who assured me you were overqualified for any job I might propose. To be on the safe side, I made discreet inquiries. I talked with a Russian in Little Odessa whose ex-wife stole his Rottweiler when he was missing some alimony payments. The person in question compared you to a long-distance runner. He told me once you started something, you finished it."
Martin put two and two together. "Oscar Kastner can't be your real name," he said, thinking out loud. "A KGB defector living in Brooklyn under an assumed name. There will surely be an elaborate cover story to go with the pseudonym. Means that you, like the other Soviet defectors, must be in the FBI's witness protection program. According to your daughter, you came here in 1988, which means the CIA has long since wrung you dry and probably doesn't return your calls if you make any. Which suggests that your friend in Washington who gave you my name is your FBI handler." So that was how Crystal Quest had gotten wind of Stella's visit to the pool parlor. Someone in the FBI had heard that an ex-CIA type was playing detective in Crown Heights and passed Martin's name on to Kastner. The FBI clerks who keep tabs on people in the protection program would have circulated a routine contact report when a former KGB officer announced his intention of employing a former CIA officer, even if the case in question had nothing to do with CIA operations. Somewhere in the labyrinthian corridors of Langley, a warning buzzer would have gone off. It had probably been the one wired to Quest's brain. Did this mean that Kastner's missing son-in-law had some connection to past or present CIA operations? Martin decided it was an angle worth considering.
"He is pretty rapid for a long-distance runner," Kastner was telling his daughter. "My FBI friend said you were discharged from the CIA in 1994. He did not explain why, except to say it had nothing to do with stealing money or selling secrets or anything unpleasant like that."
"I'm relieved you're both on the same side," Stella ventured from her perch on the ladder.
Martin batted a palm to disperse Kastner's cigarette smoke. "Why didn't you ask the FBI to try and find your missing son-in-law?"
"First thing I tried. They stretched some rules and searched the computer database for missing persons who had turned up dead. Unfortunately, none of them fit Samat's description."
Martin smiled. "Unfortunately?" Kastner's craggy features twisted into a scowl.
"I speak American with an accent. Stella never stops correcting me, but I pick my words as if my life depended on their accuracy."
"I can vouch for Kastner's accent," Stella said with a laugh.
"You call your father Kastner?"
"Sure. You've already figured out that's not his real name. It's the name the FBI gave him when he came into the Witness Protection Program. Calling my father Kastner is a running joke between us. Isn't it, Kastner?"
"It reminds us who we're not."
Martin turned to Stella.
"Meeting your father explains a lot."
"Such as?" she demanded.
"It explains how you played along so quickly when I phoned this morning. You understood that I thought the phone might be tapped. You are your father's daughter."
"She was raised to be discreet when it comes to telephones," Kastner agreed with evident pride. "She knows enough tradecraft to pay attention to people who are window shopping for objects they do not seem likely to buy. Women and fishing rods, for example, or men and ladies' undergarments."
"You really didn't need to go around the block twice," Stella told Martin. "I promise you I wasn't followed when I came to see you. I wasn't followed on the way home either."
"That being the case, how come the folks I used to work for are trying to discourage me from getting involved with missing husbands?"
Kastner manipulated the joystick. The wheelchair jerked toward Martin.
"How do you know they know?" he asked quietly.
"A woman named Fred Astaire whispered in my ear."
Kastner said,
"I can see from the look in your eyes that you do not consider this Fred Astaire person to be a friend."
"It takes a lot of energy to dislike someone. Occasionally I make the effort."
Stella was following her own thoughts.
"Maybe your pool parlor was bugged," she suggested. "Maybe they hid a microphone in that Civil War rifle of yours."
Martin shook his head. "If they had bugged my loft, they would have heard me refuse to take the case and not gone out of their way to lean on me." Tilting his large head, Kastner thought out loud.
"The tip could have come from the FBI. Someone there might have routinely informed my CIA conducting officer if it looked as if you might become involved with me. But you probably figured that out already."
Martin was mightily relieved to hear him reach this conclusion. It underscored his credibility. Kastner stared at Martin, his jaw screwed up.
"Stella told me you refused to take the case. Why did you modify your mind?"
Stella kept her eyes on Martin as she spoke to her father.
"He didn't modify his mind, Kastner. He modified his heart."
"Respond to the question, if you please," Kastner instructed his visitor.
"Let's chalk it up to an unhealthy curiosity. I'd like to know why the CIA doesn't want this particular missing husband found. That, and the fact that I don't appreciate having an unpleasant woman who munches ice cubes tell me what I can or cannot do."
"I like you," Kastner burst out, his face breaking into a lopsided smile. "I like him," he informed his daughter. "But he would not have gone very far in our Komitet Gosudarstvenoy Bezopasnosti. He is too much of a loner. We did not trust the loners. We only recruited people who are comfortable serving as cogs in the machine."
"Which directorate?" Martin asked. The bluntness of Martin's question made Stella wince. In her experience, people talking about intelligence matters usually beat around the bush.
In the USA, Kastner, she told her father, who was visibly flustered, they call this talking turkey.
Kastner cleared his throat. The Sixth Chief Directorate, he said, adapting to the situation.
I was the second deputy to the man who ran the directorate.
Uh-huh. The Russian looked at his daughter.
What does it mean, uh-huh?
It means he is familiar with the Sixth Chief Directorate, Kastner.
In fact, Martin had more than a passing acquaintance with this particular directorate. At one point in the late 80s, Lincoln Dittman had recruited a KGB officer in Istanbul. Lincoln had made his pitch when he heard on the grapevine that the officer's younger brother had been arrested for being out of step during a military drill. The instructor had accused him of sabotaging the parade to discredit the Glorious Red Army. Lincoln had arranged to smuggle the disenchanted KGB officer and his family out of Istanbul in return for a roll of microfilm filled with Sixth Chief Directorate documents. The material provided the CIA with its first inside look into the operations of this up-to-then secret section. It had been carved out of the KGB directorate structure back in the 60s to keep track of economic crimes. In 1987, when what the Soviets called cooperatives and the world referred to as free market enterprises were legalized by Comrade Gorbachev, the Sixth Chief Directorate shifted gears to keep track of these new businesses. As the economy, crippled by inflation and corruption at the most senior levels of government, began to stall, gangster capitalism thrived. Cooperatives had to buy protection, what the Russians called krisha, or a roof, from the hundreds of gangs sprouting in Moscow and other cities if they wanted to stay in business. When the Sixth Chief Directorate found it couldn't crush the gangs and protect the emerging market economy, it simply stopped trying and joined in the free-for-all looting of the country. Martin remembered Stella's saying that her father had emigrated to America in 1988. If he had been getting rich on the looting, he would have stayed and skimmed off his share, which meant he was one of those die-hard socialists who blamed Gorbachev and his restructuring for wrecking 70 years of Soviet communism. In short, Kastner was probably the rarest of birds, an ardent, if disheartened, Marxist condemned to live out his days in capitalist America.
"You are thinking so hard smoke is emerging from your ears," Kastner said with a laugh. "What conclusion have you reached?"
"I like you too," Martin declared. "I like your father," he told Stella. "Fact is, he wouldn't have lasted long in the CIA. He is far too idealistic for a shop that prides itself on the virtuosity of its pragmatists. Unlike your father, Americans aren't interested in constructing a utopia for the simple reason they believe they're living in one." Stella seemed stunned.
"I like that you like Kastner, and for the right reasons," she said softly.
Kastner, his nerves frayed, swiveled his wheelchair to one side and then the other.
"It remains for us to put our heads together and figure out why the lady with the pseudonym Fred Astaire does not want my son-in-law, Samat, to be discovered."
Martin permitted a rare half-smile onto his lips.
"To do that, I'm going to have to discover Samat."
Stella disappeared to brew up some tea and hurried back minutes later, carrying a tray with a jar of jam and three steaming cups on it. She found her father and Martin, their knees almost touching, deep in conversation. Martin was smoking one of his wafer-thin beedies. Her father had started another cigarette, but held it at arm's length so the smoke wouldn't obscure Martin.
"Somehow managed to falsify the records, so the party would not know his mother was Jewish," Kastner was explaining. "His father was an Armenian doctor and a member of the party. At one point he was accused of being an enemy of the people and sent to Siberia, where he died. The post-Stalinist program to rehabilitate people falsely accused of crimes counted in Samat's favor when he applied to the Forestry Institute. The state had killed his father, so it felt it had to compensate the son."
Martin nodded. "I seem to recall reading about your famous Forestry Institute that taught everything except forestry." Kastner set aside his cigarette in a saucer and stirred a spoonful of jam into one of the cups. Blowing noisily across it, he sipped at the scalding tea.
"It was the secret institute for our space program," he said. "In the 70s, it was the best place in the Soviet Union to study computer science. Samat went on to do advanced studies at the State Planning Agency's Higher Economics School. When he graduated near the top of his class, he was drafted into the KGB. Because of his computer skills, he was posted to the Sixth Chief Directorate."
"You knew him personally?"
"He was assigned to several cases I worked on. He became an expert on money laundering techniques. He knew everything there was to know about offshore banks and bearer share business operations. In 1991, when Yeltsin ousted Gorbachev and took power, one of the first things he did was break up our Committee for State Security, at which point a great many KGB officers found themselves suddenly unemployed and scrambling to make a living. Samat was one of them.
You were in America by then. How do you know all this?
Your Central Intelligence Agency encouraged me to keep in touch with the Sixth Directorate. They wanted me to recruit agents in place.
Did you succeed?
Kastner flashed a pained smile. Martin said, I take back the question. So we're up to where Samat, with the KGB closing down its shop, starts looking at the help wanted ads. What kind of job did he land?
He ended up working for one of the rising stars in the private sector. Someone who had his own model of how to make the transition from socialism to market-oriented capitalism. His solution was gangster capitalism. He was one of the gangsters the Sixth Chief Directorate kept track of when I was there. Samat, with his knowledge of money laundering techniques, quickly worked his way up to become the organization's financial wizard. He was the one who brought the shell game to Russia. You have seen the Negroes playing the shell game on street corners down on Rogers Avenue. They fold your $10 bill until it is the size of a walnut, and put it under a seashell and move it around with two other shells. When they stop, your $10 bill has disappeared. Samat did the same thing, but on a much larger scale.
And this is the Russian Lubavitch who wanted to marry your daughter and live in Israel?
Kastner nodded heavily.
At one point, the CIA asked me to try and recruit Samat. They arranged for me to talk with him on the telephone when he was in Geneva. I spoke of a secret account that could be his if he came over. I named a sum of money that would be deposited in his account. He laughed and replied that the sum of money they were suggesting was the loose change in his pocket. He told me the CIA could not afford to pay him a tenth of what he was earning. When Samat returned to Russia, he made sure everyone knew the CIA had attempted to recruit him. There was even a satiric article published in Pravda describing the clumsy approach by a defector.
When did Samat get in touch with you about marrying your daughter? Martin asked.
It was not Samat who contacted Kastner, Stella said. Samat's employer, who happened to be Samat's uncle, his father's brother, is the one who got in touch with Kastner.
Martin looked from one to the other.
And who was Samat's employer?
Kastner cleared his throat. It was Tsvetan Ugorzhilov, the one known as the oligarch.
The Tsvetan Ugorzhilov, who was on the cover of Time magazine in the early 90s?
There is only one Tsvetan Ugorzhilov, Kastner remarked with some bitterness.
You knew that Samat was working for Tsvetan Ugorzhilov when you agreed to the marriage?
Kastner looked at his daughter, then dropped his eyes. It was obviously a sore subject between them. Stella answered for her father.
It was not an accident that Tsvetan Ugorzhilov contacted Kastner. The two of them were acquainted from the days when the Sixth Chief Directorate was keeping track of the new cooperatives.
In the early 1980s, Kastner explained, Ugorzhilov was a small-time hoodlum in a small pond. He ran a used car dealership in Yerevan, the capital of Armenia. He had a KGB record. He'd been arrested in the early 70s for bribery and black market activities and sent to a gulag on the Kamchatka Peninsula for 8 years. Read Solzhenitsyn's Ivan Denisovich and you will get a glimpse of what each day of Ugorzhilov's 8 years was like. By the time he made his way back to Armenia and scraped together enough money to open the used car business, he was bitterly anti-Soviet. Bitterly anti-Russian also. He would have faded from the radar screen if he hadn't set his sights on bigger fish in bigger ponds. He came to Moscow, and in a matter of months cornered the used car market there. One by one he bought out his competitors. Those who would not sell wound up dead or maimed. The punishment handed out by the oligarch was what you Americans call cruel and unusual. He believed that it was good for business if his enemies had reason to dread him. When I spoke to Samat in Geneva, he passed on a story that Ugorzhilov had actually buried someone alive and had a road paved over him. And this while several dozen workers looked on. The story of the execution may or may not be true. Either way, it served its purpose. Few Russians were reckless enough to challenge the oligarch.
"You seem to know an awful lot about Svetlana Gorzhilov," Martin observed.
"I was the conducting officer in charge of the investigation into the oligarch's affairs."
Martin saw where the story was going.
"I'll take a wild guess. He paid off the Sixth Directorate."
Kastner didn't respond for a moment.
"You have to put yourself in our shoes," he said finally. "We were honest cops, and we went after him in a straightforward manner. But he bought the minister in the Kremlin who ran the KGB. Then he bought my colleague, who was the head of the Sixth Chief Directorate. And then he turned to me and put a thick packet of money on the table. This at a time when we sometimes went several months without drawing a salary because of the economic chaos. What was I to do? If I accepted, I would be on his payroll. If I refused, I would seriously compromise my life expectancy."
"So you defected to America?" Kastner plucked a cigarette from the saucer and inhaled deeply, then sniffed at the smoke in the air.
"It was the only solution," he said.
"Knowing what you knew about Uncle Ugor Zhilov, why did you agree to let your daughter marry his nephew Samat?"
Stella came to her father's defense.
"Kastner agreed because he didn't have a choice."
Kastner said very quietly,
"You do not understand how things worked after communism collapsed. One morning there arrived in my mailbox downstairs here on President Street a letter typed on expensive bonded paper. It was not signed, but I immediately understood where it came from. The writer said that his nephew was obliged to leave Russia, and quickly. It said that the best place for him to go would be Israel. It was a time when Jews were queuing up by the tens of thousands for visas at the Israeli embassy in Moscow. The Israeli Mossad, fearful that what was left of the KGB apparatus would try to infiltrate agents into Israel, was screening the Jewish applicants very carefully. And carefully meant slowly. Ugor Zhilov obviously knew that my daughter Yelena had joined the Lubavitch sect soon after we settled in Crown Heights. He knew that the Lubavitchers had a lot of influence when it came to getting Jews into Israel. They could arrange for the Israeli immigration authorities to speed things up if there was a Lubavitch marriage involved, especially if the newlyweds planned to live in one of the Jewish settlements on the West Bank, which the Israeli government at the time was eager to populate.
Martin felt claustrophobic in the airless closet. He had a visceral revulsion for closed spaces without windows.
"Something doesn't make sense here," he said, eyeing the door, mastering an urge to throw it open. "How could Svetlana Ugorzhilov send a letter to you if you were in the FBI's witness protection?"
Martin's mouth sagged open. The answer to his question came to him before Kastner supplied it.
"It was because he was able to send a letter to me," Kastner said. "Despite my being in the FBI program, that it was out of the realm of possibility to refuse him. Svetlana Ugorzhilov is one of the richest men in all of Russia. One of the 50 richest men in the world, according to that article in Time. He has a long arm, long enough to reach someone who has been given a new identity and lives on President Street in Crown Heights."
He glanced at Stella, and the two exchanged grim smiles.
"Long enough," Kastner continued, "to reach his two beautiful girls also. When the oligarch asked for a favor, it is not healthy to refuse if you are confined to a wheelchair and have nowhere else to defect to."
Martin remembered the words from the Bob Dylan song he'd heard in the street, and he repeated them aloud. "Not much is really sacred."
"Not true," Kastner burst out. "Many things are still sacred. Protecting my daughters is at the top of the list."
"Kastner could not be expected to anticipate how Samat would mistreat Yelena," Stella put in. "It was not his fault."
Kastner cut her off.
"Whose fault was it if not mine?" he said despondently.
"Aren't you running a risk by hiring me to find this Samat?"
"I only want him to give my Yelena the religious divorce so she can marry again. What he does with his life after that is his affair. Surely this is not an unreasonable request."
Kastner worked the joystick, backing the wheelchair into the wall with a light thud. He shrugged his heavy shoulders as if he were trying to rid himself of a weight.
"In terms of money, how do we arrange this?"
"I pay my way with credit cards. When the credit card people ask me for money, I will ask you to pay my expenses. If I find Samat and your daughter gets her get, We'll figure out what that's worth to you. If I don't find him, you'll be out of pocket my expenses, nothing more.
In your pool parlor, you spoke of the problem of searching for a needle in a field of haystacks, Stella said. Where on earth do you begin looking for it?
Everyone is somewhere, Martin informed her. We'll start in Israel. Stella, startled, said,
We?
Martin nodded. First off, there's your sister. She'll trust me more if you're with me when I meet her. Then there's Samat. Someone on the run can easily change his appearances, the color and length of his hair, for instance. He could even pass himself off as an Arab and cover his head with a kafir. I need to have someone with me who could pick him out of a crowd if she only saw his seaweed-green eyes.
That more or less narrows it down to me, Stella agreed.
1997. Min sleepwalks through one-night stands. Dressed in loose-fitting silk pants and a high-necked silk blouse with a dragon embroidered on the back, Min was clearing away the last of the dirty lunch dishes when So-Xing poked his head through the kitchen doors and asked her if she would run upstairs and check Martin's beehives. He would do it himself, he said, but he was expecting a delivery of Formosan beer and wanted to count the cartons before they stored them in the cellar to make sure he wasn't being shortchanged. Sure, Min said, no problem. She opened the cash register and retrieved Martin's keys and headed for the street, glad to have a few minutes to herself. She wondered if So suspected that she had slept with Martin. She thought she'd spotted something resembling a leer in his old eyes when So raised the subject of their upstairs neighbor earlier that week. He had been speaking in English but had referred to Martin using the Chinese word for hermit. Where do you think Yin Shi goes when he goes? So had asked. Min had hunched her muscular shoulders into a shrug. It's not part of my job to keep track of the customers, she'd replied testily. No reason climb on high horse, So had said, whisking a fly from the bar with the back of his only hand. Not a crime to think you could know, okay? And he had smiled so wickedly that the several gold teeth in his mouth flashed into view. Well, I don't know and I couldn't care less, Min had insisted. Pivoting on a heel, she had stalked off so So would get the message. She didn't appreciate his sticking his nose into her love life, or lack of same. Now Min rubbed her sleeve across the Private Eye logo on Martin's front door to clean the rain stains off of it, then let herself in and, taking the steps two at a time, climbed to the pool parlor. Actually, she did wonder where Martin had gone off to, wondered too why he hadn't left a message for her as well as So. She attributed it to Martin's shyness. He would have been mortified if he thought So had gotten wind of their relationship, assuming you could call their very occasional evenings together a relationship. She meandered through the pool parlor, brushing her fingers over his Civil War guns and the folders on his desk and the unopened cartons that contained heaven knows what. Soon after he'd moved in, she had asked him if he wanted help opening them. He'd kicked at one of the cartons and had said he didn't need to open them. He knew what was inside. The reply struck her as being very in character. When Min thought about it, which was more often than she liked to admit, the fact that she really wasn't sure where she stood with Yin Shi exasperated her. He always seemed happy enough to see her, but he never went out of his way to initiate meetings. Min had been raised in Lower Manhattan's Chinatown, a cauldron simmering with refugees of one sort or another, so she knew one when she saw one. The thing that betrayed them was that they seemed to be alone even in a crowd. She herself was in the country illegally, a refugee from Taiwan. Min was not even her real name, a detail she'd never revealed to Martin for fear he might be shocked. Sometimes she had the weird feeling that Martin, too, was some kind of refugee, though from what she had no clue. Yin Shi lived what she thought of as a boring life, ordering up the same dishes three or four nights a week, attending to his hives on the roof, making love to her when she turned up at his door. For excitement, he broke into hotel rooms to photograph husbands committing adultery, though when he described what he did for a living, he managed to make even that sound boring. The single time she had raised the subject of boredom, he had astonished her by admitting that he relished it. Boring himself to death, he insisted, was how he planned to spend the rest of his life. At the time, Min had thought it was one of those things you say to sound clever. Only later did it dawn on her that he'd meant every word, that boring yourself to death was a way of committing suicide in slow motion. Stepping into the back room, Min straightened the sheets and blanket on the cot, emptied the water from the plastic basin on the floor, closed the refrigerator door, put away the dishes that Martin had finally gotten around to washing. She retrieved Martin's faded white jumpsuit and, rolling up the cuffs and the sleeves, slipped into it and zipped up the front. She put on the pith helmet with the mosquito netting hanging from it and took a look at herself in the cracked mirror over the bathroom sink. The outfit was not what you would call feng shui. Taking Martin's smoke gun from under the sink, she made her way up the stairs to the roof. The sun, high overhead, was burning off the last drops of rain that had fallen the previous night. Vapor rose from shallow puddles as she crossed the roof to the hives. Martin had bought them and the equipment and even the first queen bees from a catalog when he got it into his head to raise bees. In the beginning, he had pored over the instruction book that came with the hives. Then he dragged a chair up to the roof and had spent hours staring at the colonies, trying to figure out if there was a flight pattern to the swarm's movements, a method to its apparent madness. Min had never seen him do anything with such intensity. When he'd begun inspecting and cleaning the frames, he'd worn gloves, but he discarded them when Min happened to mention the Chinese belief that bee stings stimulated your hormones and increased your sex drive. Not that the subsequent stings on his hands had changed anything. It was invariably Min who made the first move toward the cot in the back of the loft, pulling Martin into the room, onto the cot, peeling off her clothing, and then his. He made love to her cautiously, as if, she finally realized, he, not she, were fragile, as if he were afraid to let emotions surface that he might not be able to control. Min was crouching in front of the first hive, preparing the smoker, ruminating on how making love with Martin had been like sleepwalking through a string of one-night stands that were physically satisfying but emotionally frustrating, when the dum-dum bullet plunged into the frames. There was an instant of absolute silence, as if the 20,000 residents of the hive, those that had survived the impact, had been reduced to a state of catatonic bewilderment. Then a raging yellowish-brown football-sized swarm burst out of the hive, with such ferocity it knocked Min over backward. The pith helmet and veil flew off to one side, and the bees attacked her nostrils and her eyes, planting their darts with savage vengeance. She clenched her fingers into fists and hammered wildly at the layers of bees encrusting her skin, crushing them by the hundreds until her knuckles were covered with a sticky residue. There was no longer a sun overhead, only a thick carpet of rioting insects ricocheting off one another as they fought for a turn at the intruder who had wrecked their hive. Her face and lids swelling, Min slumped back onto the hot tar paper of the roof, swatting weakly at the bees the way Tso had whisked at the fly on the bar. As the pain gave way to numbness, she heard a voice that sounded remarkably like her own, telling Martin that, hey, you really shouldn't wear gloves. Sure, there's a reason why. According to the Chinese, bee stings can stimulate your... 1997. Oskar Alexandrovich Kastner discovers the weight of a cigarette. The two men in Con Ed uniforms parked their repair truck in the narrow alley between President and Carol and made their way on foot to the only back garden on the block protected by a chain-link fence. One of the men muttered something into a walkie-talkie, listened for a response, and nodded to his colleague when he heard it. The second man produced a key, opened a door in the fence, and used the same key to switch off the alarm box inside. The two, walking soundlessly on crepe-soled shoes, climbed the stairs to the porch. Using the second key, they let themselves into the kitchen at the rear of the house and punched the code into the alarm there. They stood motionless for several minutes, their eyes fixed on the ceiling. When they heard the muffled scrape of a wheelchair rolling along a hallway over their heads, the two men produced pistols fitted with silencers and started up the back staircase. Reaching the first floor, they could hear a radio playing in the front room. Gripping their pistols with both hands, angling the barrels up, they worked their way along the hall to the closed door and flattened themselves against the wall on either side of it. One of the men tapped the side of his nose to indicate he had gotten a whiff of foul-smelling cigarette smoke. Their quarry was inside the room. Baring his teeth in a tight smile, his companion grasped the knob and flung open the door, and the two of them, hunched over to keep their profiles low, burst into the room. Oskar Alexandrovich Kastner, sitting in his wheelchair next to the window, was oiling the firing mechanism on a Soviet PPSH-41, a Second World War automatic weapon in mint condition. Smoke coiled up from the cigarette burning in an ashtray. Kastner's heavy-lidded eyes blinked slowly as he took in the intruders. One appeared much older than the other, but the younger man, gesturing to the older to shut the door, seemed to be in charge.
Virusky? Kastner inquired.
Da, Yaruski, replied the younger Con Ed man.
Igdia vasha doch.
Kastner eyed the pearl-handled Tula Tokarev on the table, a 1930s pistol that he always kept charged, but he knew he could never reach it.
Я не знаю, he replied.
He was not about to tell them that Stella was on her way to Israel, accompanied by a CIA agent turned detective who lived over a Chinese restaurant. He wondered how the two killers had broken through the chain-link fence and gotten into the kitchen without tripping the alarms.
You took your time getting here, Kastner growled in English. 9 years.
He set the PPSH down and, working the joystick, maneuvered the wheelchair so that his back was to the intruders.
Kto vas poslal? He asked.
Oligarch, the younger gunman said with a ruthless snicker.
Gazing out the window, Kastner caught sight of two small Lubavitch boys, dressed in black like their fathers, hurrying down the street. He knew from Yelena that they expected the Messiah to appear at any moment and redeem mankind. Maybe this Messiah had turned up and the boys were actually angels on their way to welcome him. He himself would surely end up where angels fear to tread, as that song Stella played on the Victrola put it. Kastner gasped when he felt the needle prick the skin of his back next to the shoulder blade. In his day, the KGB specialists in wet work had favored a tasteless, colorless rat poison that thinned the blood and brought breathing to an abrupt halt. The oligarch's men would surely be using something more sophisticated and less traceable, perhaps one of those newfangled adrenaline-like substances that caused widespread gastric bleeding and eventually death. Or better still, a clotting agent that blocked a coronary artery and triggered what doctors called a myocardial infarction and laymen referred to as a heart attack. On the off chance that one of the angels might ask him to identify himself, Kastner tried to recollect what his name had been before the FBI assigned the pseudonym Oscar. It irritated him that he was unable to remember what his mother had called him as a child. If he could suck on his cigarette, it would surely calm his nerves long enough for the name to come back to him. Moving languidly, as if he were underwater, Kastner reached for the ashtray. With great concentration, he managed to pinch the cigarette between his thumb and two fingers, only to discover that it was too heavy to lift. 1987. Dante Pippin becomes an IRA bomber. Assembled in a windowless storage room in a basement of Langley filled with empty water coolers, the eight people around the conference table started, as always, with the family name, and in short order narrowed the list down to one that had an Irish ring to it, but then spent the next half hour debating how it should be spelled. In the end, the chairman, a station chief who reported directly to Crystal Quest, the new deputy director of operations, turned to the agent known as Martin Odom, who had been following the discussion from a chair tilted back against the wall. As Martin's Odom legend had been burned and he would be the person employing the new identity, it would save time if he settled on the spelling. Without a moment's hesitation, Martin opted for Pippin with three P's. I've been reading newspaper stories about a young black baseball player at the University of Central Arkansas named Scotty Pippin, Martin explained, so I thought Pippin would have the advantage of being easy to remember. Pippin it is, announced the chairman and turned to the selection of a Christian name to go with Pippin. The junior member of the Legend Committee, a Yale-educated aversion therapist, sarcastically suggested that they might want to go whole hog and use Scotty as the Christian name. Maggie Poole, who had read medieval French history as an Oxford undergraduate and liked to salt her conversation with French words, shook her head.
You're all going to think I'm off the wall, but I came up with a name in my dreams last night that I consider parfait. Dante, as in Dante Alighieri?
She looked around the table expectantly. The only other woman on the committee, a lexicographer on loan from the University of Chicago, groaned. Problem with Dante Pippin, she had said, is it wouldn't go unnoticed. People tend to remember a name like that.
But don't you see, that's exactly what makes it an excellent choice, exclaimed Maggie Poole. Nobody thumbing down a list of names would suspect Dante Pippin of being a pseudonym, precisely because it stands out in a crowd.
She has a point, agreed the committee's doyen, a gargoyle-like CIA veteran who had started out creating legends for OSS agents during World War II.
I will admit I don't dislike the sound of Dante, ventured the aversion therapist.
The chairman looked at Martin.
What do you think? He asked.
Martin repeated the names several times. Dante, Dante Pippin.
Uh-huh, I think it suits me. I can live with Dante Pippin.
Once the committee had decided on a name, the rest of the cover story fell neatly into place.
Our Dante Pippin is obviously Irish, born, say, in County Cork.
Where in County Cork?
I once vacationed in a seaport called Castletownbere,
said the aversion therapist. Castletown Bear, Cork, has a good ring to it. We'll send him there for a week of R&R. He can get a local map and the phone book and fix in his head the names of the streets and hotels and stores.
Castletown Bear is a fishing port. He would have worked on a salmon trawler as a teenager. Then, when the economy turned bad, he would have gone off to try his luck in the New World, where he will have picked up a lot about the history of the Irish in America. The potato famine of 1840 that brought the first Irish immigrants to our shores, the Civil War draft riots, that sort of thing. If he comes from Castletown Bear, he must be Catholic. For the price of a generous donation, we can probably get the local Castletown Bear church to slip his name into its baptism records. One fine day, like many, if not most, Irishmen, he would have become fed up with the church. A lapsed Catholic, then, said the chairman, jotting the biographical detail down on his yellow pad. A very lapsed Catholic, Martin piped up from his place along the wall.
Just because he's lapsed doesn't mean his family will have lapsed. Why don't we give him a brother and a sister who are in the church but can't be traced because they are no longer living under the name Pippin? Brother such and such, sister such and such.
The brother could be a Jesuit priest in the Congo, converting the natives to Jesus at the bitter end of some crocodile-infested river.
And the sister, let's put her in a convent hospital in the back country of the Ivory Coast.
She will have taken a vow of silence, which means she couldn't be interviewed even if someone got to her.
Is Dante Pippin a smoker or non-smoker?
The chairman turned to Martin, who said, I've been trying to cut down. If Dante Pippin is supposed to be a non-smoker, it'll give me an incentive to go cold turkey.
Non-smoker it is, then.
Be careful you don't put on weight. The CIA takes a dim view of overweight agents.
We ought to hire one or two. Being obese would be a perfect cover.
Even if our Dante Pippin's a lapsed Catholic, he would still have gone to Catholic school as a child. He would have been taught to believe that the seven sacraments—baptism, confirmation, Eucharist, confession, anointing of the sick, matrimony, and holy orders—could see you through a lifetime of troubles. The chairman scribbled another note on his pad.
That's a good point, he said. We'll get someone to teach him rosaries in Latin. He could slip them into the conversation to lend credibility to the new identity.
Which brings us to his occupation. What exactly does our Dante Pippin do in life?
The chairman picked up Martin Odom's 201 Central Registry folder and extracted the bio file.
Oh dear, our Martin Odom can be said to be a Renaissance man only if one defines Renaissance narrowly. He was born in Lebanon County, Pennsylvania, and spent the first 8 years of his life in a Pennsylvania backwater called Jonestown, where his father owned a small factory manufacturing underwear for the U.S. Army during World War II. After the war, the underwear business went bankrupt, and the elder Odom moved the family to Crown Heights, Brooklyn, to start an electrical appliance business. Crown Heights is where Martin was brought up.
Being brought up in Brooklyn is not the most auspicious beginning for a Renaissance man, even defined narrowly, quipped Maggie Poole. She twisted in her seat toward Martin. I'm not ruffling your feathers, am I?
Martin only smiled.
Yes, well, the chairman continued, our man majored in commerce and minored in Russian at a Long Island State College, but never seems to have earned a degree. During vacations, he climbed the lower Alps and the more modest American mountain ranges. At loose ends, he joined the army to see the world and wound up, God knows why, toiling for military intelligence, where he focused on anti-communist dissidents in the satellite states of Eastern Europe. Do I have that right, Martin?
Ah, here's something positively intriguing. When he was younger, he worked in the private sector with explosives.
Maggie Poole turned to Martin and asked, What précisément did you do with explosives?
Martin rocked his chair off the wall onto its four legs.
It was a summer job, really. I worked for a construction company demolishing old buildings that were going to be replaced, then blasting through bedrock to make way for the sub-basement garages. I was the guy who shouted through a bullhorn for everyone to clear the area.
But did you know anything about dynamite?
I picked up a bit here and a bit there, hanging around the dynamiters. I bought some books and studied the subject. By the end of the summer, I had my own blasting license.
Did you fabricate dynamite or just light the fuses?
Either or. When I first came to work for the company, Martin said, I spent a month or two making letter bombs. Then I got promoted to rigging portable phones so that we could detonate them from a distance.
I also worked with pentaerythritol tetranitrate, which you know as PETN, an explosive of choice for terrorists. You can mix it with latex to give it plasticity and mold it to fit into anything. A telephone, a radio, a teddy bear, a cigar. You get a big bang out of relatively small amounts of PETN, and in the absence of a detonator, it's extremely stable. PETN isn't readily available on the open market, but anyone with a blasting license, which Martin Odom has, can obtain the ingredients for roughly $20 the pound. The explosive, incidentally, can pass through any airport X-ray machine in operation today. "Well, that opens up some intriguing possibilities," the chairman informed the others. "He could have done a stint as an explosive specialist at a shale quarry in Colorado, then been fired for something or other. Stealing the PETN and selling it on the open market.
Sleeping with the boss's wife.
Homosexualité, even." Martin piped up from the wall. "If you don't mind, I draw the line at having homosexuality in my legend. We'll figure out why he was fired later. What we have here is an Irish Catholic. Lapsed, don't forget he's lapsed. A lapsed Irish Catholic who worked with explosives in the private sector. Only to be fired for an as-yet undetermined offense.
At which point he became a freelance explosive expert.
Could he have been a member at one point of the IRA?
An IRA dynamiter, now that's creative.
It's not something the Russians or East Europeans could verify, because the IRA is more secretive than the KGB. We could give him an arrest record in England. Arrested, questioned about an IRA bombing or two, released for lack of evidence. We could even plant small items in the press about the arrests.
We are mining a rich vein, declared the chairman, his eyes bulging with enthusiasm. What do you think, Martin?
I like it, Martin said from his seat.
Crystal Quest will like it, too.
Dante Pippin is exactly the kind of legend that will open doors. 1989. Dante Pippin sees the Milky Way in a new light. When the battered Ford reached the fertile rift known as the Bekaa Valley, the Palestinians knotted a blindfold over Dante's eyes. 20 minutes later, the two-car motorcade passed through a gate in a perimeter fence and pulled to a stop at the edge of an abandoned quarry. The Palestinians tugged at Dante from the back seat and guided him through the narrow dirt streets to the mosque on the edge of a Lebanese village. In the antechamber, his shoes and the blindfold were removed and he was led to a threadbare prayer carpet near the altar and motioned to sit. 10 minutes later, the imam slipped in through a latticed side door. A corpulent man who moved, as heavy men often do, with surprising suppleness, he settled onto the carpet facing Dante. Arranging the folds of his flowing white robe like a no-actor preoccupied with his image, he produced a string of jade worry beads and began working them through the stubby fingers of his left hand. In his early 40s, with a crew cut and a neatly trimmed beard, the imam rocked back and forth in prayer for several moments. Finally, he raised his eyes and, speaking English with a crisp British accent, announced, "I am Dr. Rizat Al-Karim."
"I suspect you know who I am," Dante replied.
The corners of the imam's mouth curled into a pudgy grin.
"Indeed I do. You are the IRA dynamiter we have heard so much about. I may say that your reputation precedes you."
Dante dismissed the compliment with a wave of his hand.
"So does your shadow when the sun is behind you."
The imam's jowls quivered in silent laughter. He held out a pack of Iranian Baman cigarettes, offering one to his visitor.
"I have stopped smoking," Dante informed his host.
"Ah, if only I could follow your example," the imam said with a sigh.
He tapped one of the thin cigarettes against the metal tray on a low table to tamp down the tobacco and slipped it between his lips. Using a Zippo flamethrower lighter with a picture of Muhammad Ali on it, he lit the cigarette and slowly exhaled.
"I envy you your strength of character. What was the secret that enabled you to give up cigarettes?"
"I convinced myself to become a different person, so to speak," Dante explained. "One day I was smoking 2 tins of Ganesh Bidis a day. When I woke up the next morning, I was someone else, and this someone else was a non-smoker."
The imam let this sink in.
"I wear the black turban of the Sayyid, which marks me as a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad and his cousin Ali. I have 2 wives, and I'm about to take a third. Many people, my wives, my children, my fighters, count on me.
It would be awkward for everyone if I were to become someone else.
If I had as many wives as you, Dante remarked, I'd probably start smoking again.
Whether you smoke or abstain, the Imam replied, his voice as soft as the cooing of a pigeon, you will only live as long as God gives you to live. In any case, longevity is not what inspires a religious man like myself.
What does inspire a religious man like yourself?
Dante heard himself ask, though he knew the answer. Benny Sapir, the Mossad spymaster who had briefed Dante Pippin in a Washington safe house before the mission, had even imitated the Imam's voice delivering stock answers to religious questions.
The thought of the angel Gabriel whispering the verses of the Holy Quran into the ear of the Prophet inspires me, the Imam was saying.
Muhammad's description in what you call the Book of the Ladder and we call the Mirage, of his ascent to the nine circles of heaven and his descent into hell, guided by the angel Gabriel, keeps me up nights. The Creator, the Maker, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, the All-Sublime, the Almighty inspires me.
The one true God inspires me. Allah inspires me. The thought of spreading his word to the infidel and killing those who do not accept it inspires me.
He held his cigarette parallel to his lips and studied it.
And what is it that inspires you, Mr. Pippin?
Dante grinned.
The money your organization deposited in my account in the Cayman Islands inspires me, Dr. Al-Karim. The prospect of monthly installments, paid in exchange for services rendered, inspires me.
No need to shake your head in disapproval. It comes as no surprise to me that you find our several inspirations discordant. Yours, of course, being the nobler of the two, and mine by far the more decadent. Since I don't believe in your God, or any God for that matter, I am what you would call a very lapsed Catholic. I think that your particular inspiration is as ephemeral as the contrails I saw on my drive down from Beirut. One moment they were there, sharp and precise, each with a silver Israeli jet fighter streaking through the crystal Lebanese sky at the cusp. The next they were thickening and drifting, and eventually dissipating in the high winds. The Imam considered this.
I can see you are not a timid man, Mr. Pippin. You speak your mind. A Muslim who permitted himself to say what you have said would be putting his limbs, perhaps even his life, in jeopardy. But we must make allowances for a very lapsed Catholic, especially one who has come all this way to teach our Fedayeen how to devise bombs to blow up the Israeli occupiers of Lebanon and Palestine.
He leaned toward Dante. Our representative in Paris who recruited you said you were born in an Irish town with the curious name of Castletown Bear.
Dante nodded. It's a smudge on the map on the southern coast of the Barra Peninsula in County Cork. Fishing port. I worked on one of the salmon trawlers before I went off to seek my fortune where the streets are paved with gold.
And were they paved with gold, Mr. Pippin?
Dante laughed under his breath.
At least they were paved, which is more than you can say for some parts of the Barra Peninsula, or the Bekaa Valley, for that matter.
Am I correct in thinking there was an expensive restaurant in Castletown Bear called the Warehouse?
There was a pricey restaurant for the occasional tourist, but it wasn't named the Warehouse. It was called the Bank, because it was in the old bank one flight up on Main Street. Still had the bank vault in the back when I was there. I seem to remember a Mary McCullough ran it in the 60s. I went to school with one of her daughters, a pretty little thing we called Deirdre of the Sorrows, because she made so many of us sorry when we discovered we couldn't sweet-talk her into bed.
You were arrested by Scotland Yard following the explosion of a bomb on a bus near Bush House, the BBC building in London.
Is that a question or a statement of fact?
A statement of fact that I'd like you to corroborate, Mr. Pippin.
I was killing time in London when the bus blew, Dante said, his eyes blinking innocently. The coppers barged into a licensed tabernacle and more or less picked up anyone who spoke the King's English with an Irish accent. They were obliged to release me after 48 hours for want of evidence. Bloody bastards never even apologized.
Did you blow up the bus, Mr. Pippin?
I did not. But the two who did learned which side was up from yours truly. The Imam smiled thinly. Glancing at a wall clock with a silhouette of Ayatollah Khomeini on its face, he pushed himself to his feet and started to leave. At the door, he turned back.
I seldom have the chance to speak with an Occidental non-believer, Mr. Pippin, especially one who is not in awe of me. Talking with you is going to be an enlightening experience. One must know the enemy before one can defeat him.
I invite you to visit me in my study after your afternoon classes, every day of the week except Friday. I will offer you mint tea and honey cakes. You can reciprocate by offering me insights into the secular mentality. The pleasure will... Dante started to say, but the imam had already vanished through the latticed door, which squeaked back and forth on its hinges, evidence of his passage. Dante was taken to his living quarters, a room in the back of one of the low brick houses with flat roofs, at the edge of the village beyond the perimeter of the Hezbollah camp. At sunup, an elderly woman with a veil over the lower part of her face appeared with what passed for breakfast. A steaming pot of green tea to wash down the chalk-dry biscuits covered with an oily paste made from crushed olives. Dante's bodyguard, who trailed after him everywhere, including to the outhouse, led him down the dirt path to the lip of the quarry. Several young boys in dusty striped robes were already tossing stones at a troop of goats to steer them away from the perimeter fence and up a nearby slope. A yellow Hezbollah flag, decorated with a hand holding aloft a rifle, flapped from the pole atop the brick building where the explosives and the fuses were stored. High overhead, the contrails of Israeli jets on their dawn patrols crisscrossed the sky. Dante's students, 19 fedayeen, all in their late teens or early 20s and wearing identical baggy khaki trousers and blouses and thick web belts under their robes, waited at the bottom of the quarry. An older man with an orange and white keffiyeh draped over his shoulders squatted on the rocky ground, setting out cartons filled with penta-erythritol tetranitrate, commonly known as PETN, along with latex, coils of electric wire, and plungers powered by automobile batteries. "I, Abdullah, will translate for you," the man informed Dante when he reached the floor of the quarry. "Please to speak slow in consideration of my English, which is curdled like last week's goat milk." Dante inspected the cartons, then kicked at the coils of wire and the plungers. "We will need modern detonators that can be tripped by radio-controlled devices from distant locations," he informed Abdullah. "How far will be the distance to these locations?" Abdullah inquired. Dante pointed to the goats disappearing over the top of the slope. "We will mix the PETN and the latex in a manner that I will demonstrate," he said, "and conceal the charges here in the quarry. Then we will climb to the top of that hill and detonate the explosives from there." Dante pointed to the hill and imitated the boom of the explosion. Abdullah translated for the fedayeen, and they all turned to stare at the hill. They talked excitedly among themselves, then looked at their instructor, nodding respectfully at his expertise. During the first several sessions, Dante concentrated on the PETN and the latex, showing the Hezbollah fighters how to mix the two and then mold the clay-like explosive to fit any receptacle. He filled a portable radio with explosives one day, then turned it on to demonstrate that it still functioned, which was important if you wanted to get the radio past military checkpoints or airport security. Another time, he packed the plastique into one of those newfangled satellite telephones and explained, with Abdullah translating, the advantages. If it was done correctly, you could actually telephone the target and identify his voice before setting off the charge and decapitating him. In the beginning, the young men were afraid to touch the explosive charges until they saw Dante juggling a clump of it from one hand to the other to demonstrate how stable it was. Abdullah, meanwhile, took Dante's handwritten list to Dr. Al-Karim and then set off for Beirut in the Ford with a purse full of the imam's precious American dollars to purchase the battery-operated transmitters and receivers that would go into the construction of remote detonators. The first afternoon that Dante turned up in Dr. Al-Karim's study, he found the imam seated well back from a table, leaning over his abundant stomach and typing away with two fingers on an IBM electric typewriter. From behind the building came the low hum of the gasoline-powered generator. "Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you. I would offer you a cigarette if you smoked cigarettes," the imam said, swiveling a chair to face his visitor, waving him toward a wooden kitchen chair. "Can I assume that you do not mind if I light up?" "Be my guest." The imam appeared to be puzzled. "How is it possible for me to be your guest in my house?" "It was a meaningless figure of speech," Dante conceded. "I have observed that Americans often come up with meaningless clichés when they do not know what to say." "I won't make the same mistake twice." The same woman who brought Dante breakfast appeared from the next room and set out plates filled with small honey-coated cakes and two glasses filled with mint leaves and boiling water. Nibbling on one of the cakes as he waited for the mint tea to cool, Dante took in the Spartan furnishings of the imam's study.
framed photographs of the training camp's Fedayeen graduating classes, slightly askew, as if someone had dusted them and left them askew to show they'd been cleaned, a poster depicting the golden-domed Mosque of Omar in Jerusalem tacked to one wall, the Kalashnikov in a corner with a clip in it and a spare clip taped to the stock, the glass bowl on a low table with a single goldfish circling round and round as if it were looking for the exit, the copies of Newsweek stacked on the floor near the door. Dr. Al-Karim scraped his chair around the table and, settling his bulk onto it facing his guest, warmed both his hands on the glass of mint tea. Speaking softly, selecting his words carefully, the imam said, "There was a time when people held me in high esteem. Judging from what I've seen, they still do. How long, Mr. Pippin, will this last? How long do you think one can go on preaching that the destruction of your principal enemy is inevitable without it transpiring, without losing the credibility that is indispensable to continue as the spiritual leader of a community? This is the predicament I find myself in. I must continue to hold out hope that our sacrifices will be rewarded, not only with martyrdom, but with certain victory over the Israeli occupiers of Lebanon and Palestine, and the Jews who are conspiring to take over the world. But in time, even the simplest of the Fedayeen, sent to combat the enemy, observes through binoculars that the Israelis still occupy their sandbagged fortresses in the south of Lebanon, that the wakes of their patrol boats still crisscross the waters off our coast, that the contrails of their jet aircraft still stain the sky over our heads." "Do you believe victory is inevitable?" Dante asked. "I am convinced that the Jews will one day be seen, like the Christian crusaders before them, as a footnote in the long flow of Arab history. This is written. Will it happen in my lifetime? Will it happen in the lifetime of my children?" Dr. Al-Karim sipped at the tea, then, licking his lips to savor the taste of the mint, he leaned forward. "I can buy time, Mr. Pippin, if your talents provide me with some incremental measure of success. Our Hezbollah fighters, armed with conventional weapons, are unable to inflict casualties on the better-armed Israeli soldiers occupying the zone in southern Lebanon. We attack them with mortars or artillery, fired from the heart of some Lebanese village, so that the Israelis are unable to repost. Very occasionally we manage to wound or kill one or two of them. For every one we kill, we lose 20 or 30 Fedayeen when our enemies, with remarkably accurate intelligence, descend from their fortresses to raid our bases here in the Bekaa Valley, or closer to the front lines. They always seem to know where we are, and in what strength." The imam shook his head. "We are like waves lapping against boulders on a shore. I cannot recruit and train and send into combat fighters by telling them that the boulders will, in a century or two, be washed smooth and reduced in size." "I suppose that's why you retained my services," Dante said. "Is it true that you can mold your explosives to fit almost any receptacle?" "Absolutely." "And detonate them from a great distance by radio command, as opposed to electrical wires stretched along the ground?" Dante nodded emphatically. "Hard wire on the ground is more reliable, but radio-detonated explosions are more creative." "Precisely how do radio-detonated explosions work?" "You need a transmitter, a cordless phone, a wireless intercom, a radio paging system, and a receiver, both tuned to the same frequency. The transmitter sends not just a signal, but also an audio tone, known as electronic pulses, which are modulated by the transmitter and demodulated by the receiver. The receiver picks up the transmission, demodulates the audio tone, closes the electric circuit, which sends current to the blasting cap, which in turn detonates the explosive charge. With your expertise, could we disguise the explosives in what appears to be ordinary roadside rocks and explode them from, say, a hilltop a kilometer away as an Israeli patrol passes?" "Child's play," Dante declared. The imam slapped his knee in elation. "God willing, we will bloody the Israelis, Mr. Pippin. God willing, the waves lapping against the shore will demolish the boulders in my lifetime. When we have finished with the near enemy, we will turn our attention to the distant enemy." "The Israelis are obviously the near enemy," Dante said. "But who is the distant enemy?" Dr. Al-Karim looked Dante in the eye. "Why, you, Mr. Pippin, are the distant enemy.
You and your American civilization, which considers smoking dangerous for the health, while everything else, extramarital sex, pornography, carnal secularism, materialism, is permissible. The Israelis are an outpost of your corrupt civilization. The Jews are your surrogates, dispatched to steal our land and colonize our countries and demoralize our souls and humiliate our religion. When we have defeated them, we will turn our attention to the ultimate enemy.
I can see how you might attack what you call the near enemy, Dante replied. But how will you war against a distant enemy who can obliterate you the way he would a mosquito caught in flagrante delicto on the back of his wrist?
The Imam sat back in his chair, a knowing smile flickering on his pudgy face.
We will use the vast amounts of money we earn from selling you petrol for your gas-guzzling cars to hire the talents of people like you, Mr. Pippin. American heads are already poisoned by Hollywood films and glossy magazines, such as Playboy or Hustler. We will poison their bodies. We will hijack their planes and crash them into their buildings. We will construct, with your help, the poor man's bomb, valises filled with germs or chemicals, and explode it in their cities.
Dante reached for a glass of mint tea and touched his lips to it.
I'd best be emigrating back to Ireland, then, he said lightly.
I can see that you do not take what I say seriously. No matter. The Imam pushed back his sleeve, glanced at his wristwatch, and rose to his feet.
You will sleep fitfully tonight as you turn over in your mind what I have told you.
Questions will occur to you. I invite you to come back tomorrow and pose them, Mr. Pippin. God willing, we will pick up the conversation where we left it off.
Dante stood up.
Yes, I will return. Thank you.
In the days that followed, Dante used what Abdullah had brought from Beirut to show his students how to assemble remote-controlled detonators and set off explosive charges in the quarry from the top of the nearby hill. When Dr. Al-Karim's people supplied the first molded rock made out of plaster of Paris, Dante filled it with PETN and rigged a remote detonator. The students set the molded rock down at the side of the road and tethered a lame goat 10 meters from it. Then everyone trooped up the hill. The Imam himself, hearing of the experiment, showed up at the lip of the quarry to watch. Dante waved to him, and Dr. Al-Karim, surrounded by 4 bodyguards, raised a palm in salute. One of the young Fedayeen wired the small transmitter to a car battery. Everyone turned to stare at the goat at the bottom of the quarry.
"Okay, Abdullah," Dante said. "Let her rip."
Reaching for the small radio, Abdullah rotated the switch until there was an audible click, and then depressed it. Far below, in the quarry, a dry cough of a blast stirred up a swell of dust. When it cleared, the goat had vanished. Where it had stood, the ground was saturated with blood and entrails.
"God is great," Abdullah murmured.
"PETN is greater," Dante remarked. When Dante entered the Imam's study that afternoon, Dr. Al-Karim came bounding around the desk to congratulate him.
"You have earned your wages, Mr. Pippin," he said, throwing a pulpy arm over Dante's shoulder. "My fighters are eager to use your remote control device against the Jews."
The two settled into kitchen chairs. Dr. Al-Karim produced his jade beads and began threading them through his fingers with great dexterity as Dante explained that he needed another 10 days, no more, no less, to make the Imam's Fedayeen ready for combat.
"We have waited this long," the Imam said. "Another 10 days will not inconvenience us."
The conversation drifted onto the 2-year-old Syrian occupation of parts of Lebanon. The month before Dante's arrival, Damascus had installed surface-to-air missiles in the Bekaa, a move that Hezbollah did not appreciate since it was bound to attract Israeli attention to the valley. Dr. Al-Karim wanted to know whether President Bush would put pressure on the Israelis to pull back from the buffer zone in southern Lebanon. Dante said he was far from being an expert in such matters, but he doubted it. He, in turn, wondered whether the Iranians would put pressure on the Syrians to end their virtual occupation of Lebanon now that the civil war had quieted down. The Imam replied that the death the week before of Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini had created a vacuum in the Islamic world and predicted that it would be a long time before the Shiites found someone with enough charisma to take his place. Dante asked jokingly if the Imam aspired to the job. Dr. Al-Karim took the question seriously. He stopped manipulating his worry beads and placed a finger along the side of a nostril.
"I aspire to serve God and lead my people to victory over the Jews," he said. "Nothing more."
"Tell me something, Dr. Al-Karim."
Dante hesitated. The imam's head bobbed.
Only ask, Mr. Pippin.
I notice that you often speak of the Jews, not the Israelis. I'm curious to know if Hezbollah isn't confusing the two. What I'm getting at is this. Are you anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish?
Inasmuch as Israel is an enemy state, the imam replied without hesitation, we are, of course, anti-Israeli.
He started manipulating his worry beads again.
But make no mistake, we are also anti-Jewish. Our common history goes back to the Prophet Muhammad. The Jews never recognized the legitimacy of Islam as the true religion and the Quran as the word of God.
Your critics say this attitude more or less puts you in the same boat as Adolf Hitler.
The imam shook his head vigorously. Not at all, Mr. Pippin. Our critics miss an essential point. Hitler was anti-Semite. There are enormous differences between being anti-Jewish and anti-Semite.
I'm afraid you're losing me.
Anti-Semites, Mr. Pippin, believe that once a Jew, always a Jew. For Hitler, even a Jew who converted to Christianity remained a Jew. It follows that for the Nazis in particular and for anti-Semites in general, there was no solution except what they called the final solution, namely the extermination of the Jews. Being anti-Jewish, on the other hand, implies that there is a solution short of extermination, a way for Jews to save themselves from extermination.
And what might that be?
The Jew can convert to Islam, at which point Islam will have no quarrel with him.
I see.
What do you see, Mr. Pippin?
I see that I shouldn't have started this conversation in the first place. I'm a hired gun. You pay me for services rendered, not my opinions on your opinions.
Quite right, quite right. Though if my answers don't interest you, I will admit to you that your questions interest me.
Abdullah materialized outside the window, tapping a fingernail against the pane. When the imam went over to the window, Abdullah pointed to the car winding its way up the dirt road toward the Hezbollah camp.
I had almost forgotten, Dr. Al-Karim said, turning back to Dante. I'm expecting a visitor. The Syrian commander in the Bekaa stops by every once in a while to see what we are up to. He will stay through prayers and the evening meal tomorrow. It might be wise if you keep out of sight, as I have not informed him of your presence, and the Syrians do not take kindly to foreigners in the valley.
How about if I disappear in the direction of Beirut? Dante asked. It's been almost 3 weeks since I arrived. As tomorrow is Friday and my students will be in the mosque praying, I was going to ask you for a day off.
And what will you do on this day off of yours?
In my entire life, I've never gone this long without a swill of beer. I will take my warm body off to a bar and drink a barrel of it.
Why not? Beirut has quieted down, and you have earned a day of rest. I will send Abdullah and one of my bodyguards to keep you out of harm's way.
An Irishman does not go to a licensed tabernacle to keep out of harm's way, Dr. Al-Karim.
Nevertheless, out of harm's way is where we must keep you until you have completed your work here. What you do after that is your affair.
The following afternoon, the battered Ford that had transported Dante to the Bekaa 3 weeks earlier threaded its way through a tangle of secondary roads in the direction of Beirut. The bodyguard, sporting baggy khakis and cradling a Kalashnikov with notches cut into the stock for each of his kills, sat up front bantering in Arabic with the driver, a coal-black Saudi with matted dreadlocks. Dante, wearing a coarse brown Bedouin burnous, a black-and-white checkered keffiyeh and dark sunglasses, shared the back seat with Abdullah, who climbed out of the car at each Syrian checkpoint to wave, with an imperious snap of the wrist, the letter bearing Dr. Al-Karim's seal and signature in the face of the soldiers who were, so Abdullah swore, completely illiterate. Dante, lost in thought, stared through his reflection in the window, barely noticing the dusty villages with the swarms of barefoot boys playing soccer in the unpaved streets, the crowded open-air souks with giant dish antennas for sale on one side and donkeys and camels tethered to a nearby fence, the tiled butcher shops with young girls fanning the flies off the carcasses hanging from hooks. At the outskirts of Beirut, the Ford passed through the first of the militia barricades, but, as Abdullah explained in halting English, the pimply gunmen there, though literate, were more interested in the $20 bills folded into Dr. Al-Karim's letter than the letter itself or the passengers in the car.
End of disc 2. Please continue with the next disc.